Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on how the CFPB's proposed rule will work with the TCPA. The proposed debt collection rule from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will likely result in a final rule that will overhaul the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. But there are communication components to the proposed rule that will also impact how companies in the credit and collection space comply or are asked to comply with the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. In this webinar, I'm excited to bring to you a panel of compliance experts from across the ARM industry who are here to share their insights into how the CFPB's efforts to modernize debt collection will also work within the framework of the TCPA. This webinar is being generously sponsored by TCN. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Stephanie Jackman is the leader of Ballard Spahr's debt collection team and partner located in the firm's Atlanta office. She is nationally recognized for her expertise in collections, compliance, and litigation across all segments of the financial services industry, including traditional financial products, fintech and online lending, healthcare, and student lending. Kelly Nepper-Stevens is Vice President of Legal and Compliance and Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. She serves on the Board of Directors for the Receivables Management Association International and is an ACA certified instructor. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, can be found on AccountsRecovery.net. Collection Advisor magazine named Kelly one of the 20 most powerful women in collections in 2018. Lauren Valenzuela is compliance counsel at Performant Recovery, where she advises on compliance with consumer protection laws, government regulation, licensing, litigation defense, and transactional matters. Prior to joining Performant, she was general counsel and director of compliance for Collection Technology, Inc. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion is concluded, and we'll try and take a couple as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask everyone to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation and your feedback helps me develop content that's what you're looking for, much like the topic we have for you today. And the speakers, definitely the ones we have for you today, who are people you want to hear from. So thanks in advance for sharing your insights. With that, let's move on to the discussion for today. So let's start, I usually like to start these at a fairly high level and sort of drill down as we go. So everybody knows the proposed rule specifically addresses the FDCPA, but there are ramifications that will be felt on other statutes at a state and federal level as well. Kelly, you're on my screen, so you get the honor of the first question. How do you anticipate the CFPB addressing these conflicts?
Well, first, let me say thank you, Mike Gibb, for inviting me to be here today. How lucky that I got the first question. And I'm very honored to be here and to have this discussion with Lauren and Stephanie, two of my favorite people to talk to and to pick their brains. So I don't really anticipate that the CFPB is going to do anything in regards to addressing how their proposed rule or their final rule when it comes out interacts with the TCPA. I don't think that the CFPB has jurisdiction over the TCPA, the FCC does, and so I think they're going to leave it alone. I believe, though, that they went into great detail and behind the scenes that you don't actually see, per se in the rule, to think about how things might work together, right? So let's take, for example, the topic of consent. The TCPA requires you to have consent before you, say, text a consumer or leave a pre-recorded voicemail message on a consumer's landline or cell phone, or use an automated telephone dialing service to call a consumer's cell phone. That doesn't change under the proposed debt collection rule, where they don't specifically go in and require consent to, you know, text a consumer, because that consent is covered by the TCPA, not the FDCPA. So I don't think they're going to get into ever really talking about it, because they have no jurisdiction over the TCPA. What do our other panelists think?
Kelly, this is Stephanie. Oh, Lauren, go ahead.
Nope, go ahead, Stephanie.
All right, well, we all have lots to say. This is Stephanie Jackman, and I completely agree with you. Before I explain more about why, I also want to thank Mike for giving me the opportunity to join this panel, and I'm glad to hear I'm one of your favorites, because you and Lauren are also one of my favorites, so I really feel very honored to be invited to share opportunity with both of you. I absolutely agree. In fact, I think the CFPB, to your point, is well aware of the TCPA, and in fact, may actually intend in some of the language it has used in the proposed rule that I imagine would exist in the final rule, actually intends to bring TCPA concepts, case law, et cetera, requirements into the collection space in a way that they haven't always impacted it. Because in the TCPA world, those requirements relate to marketing. We're not marketing here, right? But when we think about things that are more likely to apply, you have to be using an automatic telephone dialing system in order to have the consent provisions of the TCPA and revocation come into play, or delivering a pre-recorded message, which doesn't have to be done using an ATDS. So there are ways that engaging in collection communications, you can avoid by not delivering a pre-recorded message or using an ATDS application of the TCPA. I think the CFPB is intentionally bringing the concepts around consent and revocation that operate in that space into the collections world in a much broader sense, and that those not only will inevitably impact how these are argued in court and how people approach concept of consent and revocation to do different things, but I think that's actually intentional. And that gives me a lot of concern, because I know when I'm working in the TCPA context and the litigation there, these concepts and how they work are far from clear in many instances and very difficult to define. Lauren, I think you had some thoughts too.
Oh, sure. And thank you, Mike, for letting me participate today with also two people that I highly respect and esteem. I was really thinking, you know, I appreciate the Bureau's attempt to provide our industry guidance on how to use text messaging and emails and things like that. But I think one thing that the Bureau, I would say, kind of overlooked or underplayed was that, for example, cell phones, consumers have great control over their cell phone and their cell phone use. And I think that with modern technology like cell phones, they can easily silence or ignore or block telephone numbers. And it's kind of a little bit, I don't want to say frustrating, but challenging, very challenging to, like what Stephanie was saying, infuse TCPA consent type of concepts into their rules. It's hard for someone to build a compliance program around for example, integrating text messaging into your outbound call strategy or your contact strategy, when that the interpretations of what is an ATDS is so much in flux. So it's going to be as the months progress, it's going to be interesting to see how continued perhaps case litigation unfolds, and how it maybe the FCC finally issues some interpretive guidance. So I would say it's very there's a lot of moving targets. and I don't think the CFPB, as Stephanie was saying, was necessarily not cognizant of that, but perhaps just kind of putting it out there and kind of putting it up to us to figure out as we build our compliance program.
Okay, excellent. Appreciate the information, the feedback so far. We're off to a really good start. We have talked a little bit about consent. You know, under the proposed rule, collectors wouldn't need, that doesn't appear as though collectors are going to need consent to send text messages, but they do need so under the TCPA. So that's something we talked a little bit about already, but I'd like to maybe spend a couple of minutes more on it and maybe how this, you know, like we talked about the FCC, we're talking about sort of what's going on in the legal system with court cases. We've got the CFPB in it. So like there's a lot of different moving parts as we've discussed. How does this all sort of get fixed? I guess if I'm a collection agency and if I need to know what I can and can't do, what's going to be, you know, how am I going to sort of ultimately figure that out? Stephanie, why don't you go first this time?
Oh, sure. Give me that question. How do I fix it? So first and foremost, we need to know what the FCC's ultimate rulemaking that it is required to do after the DC Circuit's decision in the ACA case in now March of 2018. So we're a ways past it. What are they going to say? And they haven't said much. And I unfortunately don't really have a sense of if they're going to say something anytime soon. And if somebody on the panel knows more, great, because I would hazard a guess that they might not. We're coming into an election year. They are very focused on things going on with Stir Shaken and other initiatives in the call blocking context. So I'm not holding my breath that what we thought would maybe help clarify some of the contours of the TCPA, not necessarily all. I'll come back to that in a minute. I'm not holding my breath that that's coming out anytime soon. I hope I'm wrong. I hope it's imminent, but I'm not hearing that it is. And again, if anybody knows differently, let me know. But it didn't address everything here. For instance, the DC Circuit upheld what was in the omnibus order, the FCC's omnibus order from 2015 about consumers being able to revoke through any reasonable means. And, you know, I can remember talking with clients about, does that mean they can walk into, say, a branch and just say, I revoke, you know, and how do we capture that? Do we need to capture that? What do we want to do? Just because they upheld it doesn't mean the FCC won't say something more about it to, for instance, perhaps say, well, an institution can create a, just like we see with FCRA direct disputes, an address or a channel or a way for consumers to do this. And if they don't, and they can advertise that to them, and if they have it and they make it known to consumers and consumers don't use it, maybe, who knows, we have some other different option there to avoid this walking into a branch and saying, I revoke. But I don't know. And in the meantime, it's really a contextual issue. So, you know, we help clients draft consent that is as broad as it can possibly be, that specifically includes collection agencies, successors, assigned, debt buyer. I mean, you think of it, we put it there for all purposes under the sun, marketing, collections, just saying hello. Now, some clients don't want to keep it that broad, but we work really hard to help them do that. And then we do other things like bring in Reyes language to the extent that we can get any mileage out of that and try to think about ways to make consent to contact you through different channels like your cell phone or email. We don't do that now with email, but thinking to the future with what the rule is proposing. Getting that consent, making it part of the actual consideration for the contract, doing that in a way that really tries to make that as ironclad as possible. But still, there's room to debate. Does it transfer? Was it broad enough? How is it going to work? That's just on the consent side. And often we're in circumstances where the consent we're getting to communicate with somebody is a number that wasn't provided to us previously, that we've found some other way, or it's a new number. So it's later on where perhaps you're not getting the consent as broadly as you would have in the originating document. Then we have all the mess on what is revocation? What does it mean? What if a consumer says, I can't pay this debt? What do I have to understand that to mean? We have that coming up, by the way, in the TCPA context. They're saying, well, of course, if they're saying they can't pay the debt, they mean they don't want you to call them anymore. What if a consumer just says, don't call me anymore today? What if a consumer then calls you back? I mean, it doesn't take very long to start reading the cases around revocation in the TCPA context, as well as consent, to start understanding exactly what sort of, dare I say, legal morass is about to befall us. So, Mike, I really don't know how to fix it other than continuing to develop front-end compliance approaches that try to, as broadly as possible, get consent, having good training around revocation. I appreciate that the Bureau is proposing in the rule that there would be certain ways that consumers could opt out, like in a text, you include an opt-out that says reply stop, to stop text, right? And there's case law that say if a consumer does something else, like make the S a dollar sign or please stop, something to circumvent the, you know, text tools you're using in to capture that revocation, there's case law in the TCPA context that says, come on, this is a really simple thing. We're not going to do that. This looks like case creation. And some of the comment letters that were submitted and by the industry and others are asking the Bureau to be a bit more definitive, that this actually could be maybe a safe harbor. Same thing with how they're proposing you include a link or a conspicuous way for a consumer to opt out of future email. Can if we do this, can it be a safe harbor in some way to try to avoid that revocation consent mess that is in the TCPA world? Challenging, and it depends on hearing what the FCC does and then seeing what the CFPB's final rule looks like, in my view.
Hey, I would just add, I don't know how we fix it either, but one thing that I cannot help but think about is, you know, with the hurdle of obtaining consent and maybe even interpreting revocation of consent, and that coupled with the proposed rules, call caps, there's going to be, I think, a lot of unintended consequences. You know, like, for example, debt collectors will make less attempts to reach the consumer, which will essentially result in less opportunity for consumers to resolve their debts voluntarily or in a manner that's best suited for their situation. Essentially, I'm not sure if anybody's really thinking about that wholeheartedly. Essentially, these challenges and restrictions might lead to these unintended consequences where, by a natural consequence, debt collectors are going to look for other ways or speed up their collection routes and other ways, such as collecting an amount due through administrative wage garnishment or offset for federal or state debts, for example, or even through litigation.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said, and I would just say to keep track of it all, you just have to keep going on your compliance management system, right? It's a continuous circle. It's a continuous, evaluation of the policies and procedures that you have in place to guard against your legal obligations and your legal risk, right? So you're going to have your policies for the FDCPA, and those are going to change a bit when the rule comes out, depending upon what is in that final rule. But your policy around having consent and revocation of consent for text messaging is directly related to the TCPA. It's not an FDCPA, policy. They intersect when you get to the, when someone, decides to send you a note that says, I revoke my consent for you to call me on my cell phone. How are you going to treat that under the FDCPA, right? The FDCPA says that if, someone cease and desists, sends a cease and desist in writing, that you need to honor that cease and desist request. So, providing ways for consumers to, provide this information to you in a way that allows you to take it and apply it across the different obligations that you have is a good way moving forward to be thinking about how you want your product to interact, right? Because you definitely need to know how you're going to treat that. And probably a lot of people are going to say, nope, if someone specifically only revokes our consent to, you know, get telephone them under the TCPA, I'm going to count that as I'm not going to call that person anymore under the FDCPA. And I'm not going to, I'm going to revoke consent. So I'm going to be filling out two things somewhere in my collection software system. But no, I'm not going to say that that's a cease and desist request because they're not ceasing all communication. I can continue to email this consumer. I can continue to send them letters. And so if your online system that interacts with consumers, allows them to stop calls, is the way that you're asking them about stopping calls also going to provide the information that you need to determine whether they're stop call request is a revocation under the TCPA. You have to think about how all of those little things are written because they have implications under the different statutes. So if it's just saying stop calls, it's not really a revocation of the consumer's right to consent. So if that account gets withdrawn and passed on to another creditor, I wouldn't treat a stop call request as a, revocation of a consent to auto dial someone. Unless I thought that was the best thing for my company, right? And maybe both Stephanie and Lauren would think that's the best thing. That would be definitely the most conservative approach. But, if your terms and conditions that establish that consent requires it to be in writing and to say I revoke consent to auto dial, then, filling out the button that says I want you to stop calling me isn't going to get there for that revocation.
Okay, excellent. I'm going to step in for a minute and just pause the discussion and talk a little bit about the sponsor for today's webinar, and that's TCN. TCN is a leading provider of cloud-based call center technology for enterprises, contact centers, BPOs, and collection agencies worldwide. Founded in 1999, TCN combines a deep understanding of the needs of call center users with a highly affordable delivery model, ensuring immediate access to robust call center technology such as predictive dialer, IVR, call recording, and business analytics required to optimize operations and adhere to TCPA regulations. Its always-on cloud-based delivery model provides customers with immediate access to the latest version of the TCN solution, as well as the ability to quickly and easily scale and adjust to evolving business needs. TCN serves various Fortune 500 companies and enterprises in multiple industries, including newspaper, collection, education, healthcare, automotive, political, customer service, and marketing. TCN is engaged and actively involved in understanding TCPA changes and how it is changing the industry. TCN regularly speaks to local and national leaders to help educate them on matters of TCPA and compliance for the betterment of the industry as a whole. For more information, please visit www.tcn.com. Thanks again to TCN for sponsoring today's webinar. I'm sure I speak for all of us listening when I say we appreciate your generous support and your commitment to helping educate the credit collection industry. Now, let's pick up with our discussion. Kelly, your turn to answer first. No, we're going to go with Kelly this time. I know there are other types of notifications like push messages. How would those be addressed either under the TCPA or the proposed rule?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. A push message out there for those of you who are not familiar with push messages are when you get a little box on your Android or Apple phone that is telling you something. Often you can find them in your notification center too if you swipe down. So for example, right now Target has already sent me a Black Friday sneak peek push notification. And interestingly, I'm just gonna say this because from a TCPA perspective, this is interesting. I got a little underneath that push notification. It says, keep receiving notifications from the Target app and I can turn it off or I can keep them. So, agencies that use push notifications, we use push notifications, the consumer opts in. And the question about a push notification is, number one, is it a communication, right? So under the FDCPA, when you're talking about a communication, you need to think about, all right, well, if it's a debt collection communication, then Does it need to have the mini Miranda included? If it's a communication, it's going to count toward my call caps, or is it not? You know, you kind of want to figure out, is your call, is a call, right? Like a text is a call, but is a push notification a call? It depends on how that push notification is getting delivered, right? So once you determine where it falls, if you're going to treat it as a call, then yes, you need consent from the consumer. And if you're having the consumer opt in, and giving them the opportunity to opt out like Target just did on that push notification I received, then you're meeting your obligations under the TCPA. And then if you are, if it's a communication under the FDCPA, are you going to put the, mini Miranda on it? And so when you are approaching any sort of type of communication with a consumer, you want to lay out in your policies and procedures how that type of communication, no matter what it is, whether it's push notifications, whether it's Facebook advertising, you know, whatever sort of new thing you might be doing in order to interact with the modern consumer who is demanding these sort of electronic types of communications, you want to think through how each federal statute that regulates those communications applies to it, and then set up your rules accordingly. So that if you decide, yep, this is definitely a communication, then have the mini Miranda on there. If you decide, that it's a communication, do I need to have my state notice language on there? Maybe under the decision that came out in the Seventh Circuit, Lavallee versus MedOne Solutions, you're thinking, well, since my push notification does not convey any information about the debt, maybe you're saying, hi, Kelly, check your email. Or, hi, Kelly, this is a payment reminder. You know, depending upon whether or not you think it conveys an information about your debt, you might not need to put the mini Miranda on there. But, you know, certainly if you're going to count it as a communication, it definitely should count toward the number of attempts that you're making to reach a consumer in a particular time frame, whether it's a week or a month. So you just need to make sure that you have a really methodical way of approaching each method of communication from the standpoint of all the statutes that might apply to it, so that you can show that you've kind of checked your boxes there, and so that you can feel comfortable that you've set it up in a way that addresses all of those risks.
Yeah, this is Stephanie. I totally agree with you, Kelly. It's really critical because you hit on a bunch of terms. I don't know what our listeners are doing, but I kept kind of popping up when you said things like, are you going to put the mini Miranda on it? And then I thought of, there's these state laws too that can apply and require things in written communications, for instance, like your mailing address or PO box, your office hours, when are you open? There are state laws that impose additional requirements on verbal communications, like the name of who they can call back. And there are definitely arguments and people that would say text or written, text or verbal, text or both. Thinking about the TCPA, they're treated as essentially a type of verbal communication. They're a call, but they're definitely in writing as well. And these are all going to be challenges that I think confront all of us as we move forward in trying to use these technologies that really can lead to a lot of efficiencies, but are things that we're not getting answers on. I don't expect you're going to get an answer on, for instance, how do these state laws interact? It's challenging. So just being aware, and then to your point, developing strategies, approaches, and compliance relating to the same that's within your risk tolerance, is going to be critical, and then monitoring developments around it as, candidly, litigation trying to test the contours of this starts to unfold. Lavallee kind of kicked it off, but it's, I think, about to be a lot more unless the final rule gives some really more ironclad safe harbors. Some of this stuff's not realistic. It's not realistic to put your business address and office hours and things like that in a collections communication text. So what does that mean? Are you willing to take that risk? Are plaintiff lawyers going to care? These are all things that we have to be mindful of as we start using these technologies. And candidly, it's a big part of why I think the third party space has been slow, not unwilling, but slow to adopt, because these are real risks. And even within first party, these challenges are something that are coming up all the time, because they've been a little bit more willing, because they're not subject to the FDCPA, to engage in email and text opportunities. And a lot of them, candidly, are defaulting to the limited message, limited content message concept. And I say it's a concept because we're all assuming it's going to make it into the final rule and become part of the law. It's not actually there yet. It's really just a concept.
I'm curious, Stephanie, you know, like you said, you know, I like the way you put it in terms of sort of how you're just going to have to kind of keep an eye on what's going on and really kind of sort of adjust on a sort of day by day basis to, you know, any changes. Is there, you know, for collection agencies that maybe aren't as quick to adopt or maybe do get kind of caught up in something, is there some sort of, you know, equivalent of a bona fide error, and that we were, you know, defense that we were, you know, they could say we were trying to do the right thing, but, you know, the landscape is changing so fast, or the landscape hasn't addressed this yet, and this is sort of our reasoning for, you know, why we were doing what we're doing, doesn't, you know, we were trying our best kind of thing. Is that going to work?
I would certainly give it a shot. And I think the answer with, as it is with many things in the FDCPA world, in some courts it'll be enough, in some instances it might not be, just like it is now. But I don't read, and Kelly and Lauren, I don't know if you feel differently, I don't read anything in the proposed rule or anything in the TCPA context, and where I think it could come and influence how the proposed rule, once enacted, is interpreted with regard to, you know, consent and revocation type concepts. I don't see anything that would prohibit giving a bona fide error defense a shot.
I agree.
Okay, good to know. We've talked a little bit about limited content messages. Is that something, you know, do you envision that being something that would be subjected or sort of subject to the TCPA, or is that something that's going to be separate? How do you envision that sort of being addressed, Lauren?
Well, I think, you know, you go back to the basics of the TCPA, and for example, if a collector called a cell phone using an automatic telephone dialing system, and left a limited content message, or if the collector sent a limited content message via text message, or sent it via maybe a pre-recorded voice drop, for example, I think, yes, the TCPA would kick in, and therefore would need to be factored in when you're making that outbound contact. Otherwise, I would say, I can't really think of another way how the limited content message might interact with the TCPA. Can Kelly or Stephanie think of anything else?
You know, this, Stephanie, when I saw the question from Mike and was thinking about it in preparation for this webinar, I mean, yeah, to your point, they will be subject to the TCPA. They may not be collection messages within the meaning of the FDCPA, but if you're sending a limited content message using an automatic telephone dialing system, or if you decide to make some kind of limited content message into a pre-recorded message right. That you deliver through any system, including manually dialing the numbers and holding up your phone to playing of the recording, which I'm not saying anybody does, but those are divorced from each other and people forget that. You don't have to use an ATDS to send a pre-recorded message. Yes. So in implementing limited content messages to try to control risk in one context, you are potentially enhancing or increasing, I think for some companies, perhaps the contact limits will actually reduce risk, who knows, depending on how often and how aggressively they're calling, texting, et cetera. But yes, so if you you need to remember that if you're using a limited content message on an account where somebody has said stop contacting them or opted out of text, while you might not get in trouble under the FDCPA, you certainly are at risk with the TCPA.
Yep, I would agree.
Yep.
It just comes back to making sure that you think critically about how each statute impacts each type of communication. You know, just because the FDCPA under the rule allows for the limited content message doesn't mean that you can deliver that message, you know, in a way that would violate the TCPA or the FCRA or UDAP. Right? That message needs to be delivered in a way that complies with all of those statutes. And so that's the most important thing to kind of take away from when the rule does come out and you begin to assess how you're going to change your practices, don't forget about the other statutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Just want to pause for a second and remind everybody, if you have a question for any of our panelists, please type it into your Zoom webinar control panel and we'll get to it before we wrap up today. Lauren, I know you mentioned this a little bit, but I wanted to maybe see if we could spend a few more minutes and maybe get some other opinions on whether collectors should treat an opt-out request received from, you know, via a text message just to stop sending text as a cease request under the FDCPA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this to me is a tricky one because in my opinion, an opt-out in context is very narrow. It's simply informing the other party that they are opting out of communicating through that specific communication channel or method. But as we know, it's not as simple as that. And case law shows us that it's not as simple as that. I think Kelly mentioned earlier, the conservative approach is to just say, you know what, we are going to err on the side of caution and say, when we get an opt-out, we're going to treat that as a cease on the phone number, for example. But I think that's really going to boil down to a company's risk tolerance and how they want to approach that, perhaps until there are some examples, unfortunately, in the case law about opt-outs and how far that stretches or how narrow it is. So I think that's a tricky one, but I don't know. Kelly and Stephanie, what do you guys think?
I was going to, this is Kelly, kind of bring it back to something that you said earlier, Lauren, about unintended consequences. So, you know, if you choose to take that conservative approach and when someone opts out of a text message communication, you then go ahead and update that as a full cease and desist request, that actually has a pretty adverse impact on the consumer, right?
Yeah.
Because if they're really doing a full cease and desist request and, you know, you're the collection agency and they've done that, when it gets back to the creditor is going to probably evaluate that for a litigation strategy. Especially in light of, you know, the shortening of statutes of limitations across the board and the complex evaluation about, you know, when an account does go out of stat. And so, you know, I'm pretty sure that nobody wants a consumer, certainly the CFPB doesn't, and neither do, you know, creditors to have to sue as a result of, you know, an overly conservative approach to, you know, an opt-out request, which is done in a manner to try and be most deferential to the consumer and the consumer's preferences. So it really is a difficult sort of determination and thinking through how you can, you know, send that follow-up communication, for example, under the FDCPA, you know, after somebody does a cease and desist, you get one follow-up communication. Certainly that communication, if you chose to be that conservative, might, you know, might say, we see that you have opted out of, you know, text messaging. As a result of that, we're going to stop all communications to that phone number. You know, we have no other way to get in touch with you So, you know, this might be the next steps of what would happen. Unless you want to provide another method for us to communicate with you, so that we can attempt to resolve this account, you know? And thinking through maybe how your website might offer a variety of different options for a consumer to choose their preference. Like, I prefer to, you know, only get communication by email, or only get communication by letter or whatever, so that you're not foreclosing all avenues of communication, right? Because it's all about communication. The more you hear from the consumer about their ability to repay and what works best for them, the easier it is for you to communicate with the creditor about, you know, that consumer's ability to, you know, resolve the account in a timely fashion.
Yeah. Well, and on a related note, this is Stephanie. I agree with everything both of you ladies have already said. I would not treat these as a cease, as a general rule. And I agree that doing so could actually have really adverse consequences that candidly could be used against you. And if somebody wanted to kind of bring a reverse type of claim and in trying to be overbroad, you've hurt consumers and they got further into the collection process and all these bad things happened. But from a practical perspective, one of the things I've talked with some of the clients that I have who've been implementing text, again, a lot of this is in first party or creditors themselves, if I'm being completely candid, but I don't think it matters here, is there was a period of time that people started including opt-outs for TCPA purposes in their text, saying reply stop to stop. And then the consumer would reply, and then they would reply to confirm it and ask reply stop all to stop all, right? And they're trying to contour, did you just mean text? Do you mean everything? I get what they're doing. And this was going on, I don't know, maybe 14, 15, 16. And there was litigation, of course, about whether that confirmatory text back was okay. And so, you know, that's in the rear view because the Bureau has proposed that you would be able to send a confirmatory text, but all you're allowed to do is send a confirmatory text. And candidly, I don't encourage my clients to send within that confirmatory text reply, stop all. I don't like that. There's a couple reasons. And I see what the Bureau is proposing is giving me yet another leg to stand on in litigation about why saying you had some obligation to do that and that you were not allowed to just understand the reply stop in a text as to apply only to a text and didn't have to treat it more broadly using existing TCPA case law, et cetera. When you get a consumer who replies stop to a text, you already have a consumer that presumably, at least in that moment, really doesn't want to talk to you or doesn't want to get any more text or who knows. But let's just assume they don't want to talk to you. Maybe they're agitated. I don't know. Maybe they just have some other reason. But for my purposes, I want to focus there. If you then reply back, giving them an opportunity to tell you that you want it to stop more broadly, you have a really good chance that they're going to reply, stop all. I have done it. I have had people, I'm not being contacted by collection agencies, but I've had people reply, actually it's been at some industry conferences that will go unnamed over the years, reply stop to stop text. And I replied stop. And then they wrote back and they said, okay, great. Let us know if you want us to stop all. I'm like, yeah, of course I do. I just told you that. Then they sent me another confirmation. I ended up emailing the people running the conference saying, hey guys, like I'm obviously not going to sue you, but so this can spin out of control. And there are cases that say if you give them a simple reply stop and they reply stop, that's all you have to understand it to mean. So I would double down on those cases. I would double down on the Bureau saying you're not allowed to include anything else. And I would read that to say, and that means including an invitation to opt out more broadly. They currently do not have that as something they're allowing in your confirmatory text back. Presumably your confirmatory text back is just the following. Thank you, Kelly. Kelly, you're my debtor here. I'll pick on you. Thank you, Kelly. You'll receive no further text messages. Bam. If you then call me because you're being sued for not doing a cease and desist or violating the TCPA or whatever is concocted by a plaintiff's lawyer, I have a pretty good factual argument that I feel pretty solid I can defend in either context and going back and saying, Your Honor, Mr. or Mrs. Arbitrator, whatever. It was very clear what they were opting out of. They followed our directions to do it. We confirmed back the scope. I like text opt-outs that say reply stop to stop text. because then I would actually take the position my clients do not need to send a confirmatory text, and in fact shouldn't, because you've already said stop and text together to the consumer, be done with it, and then I think you can stand by that. I think that is very defensible from a litigation perspective.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah, I think your answer there also sort of addresses something that I was thinking about, and a question that's come in three parts here. And that has to do with, is an opt-out applicable to just future texting, or does it apply to that cell phone? And really, it matters how you phrase it. Opt out of texts. If you say opt out of texts, that means the consumer is opting out of text. It does not mean the consumer is opting out of calls to that phone. So the more specific you can be in your communications about how a consumer can revoke certain channels of communication, if you're very clear about what they are, as opposed to opt out, which might mean, yeah, as consumer, I thought when I was opting out via this text message to my cell phone that that meant I would get no further communications on this cell phone, right? Mm-hmm. But certainly that argument is not going to fly if it said opt out of texts. And then you get after they opt out of texts, they get an immediate, thank you, Kelly, we will no longer send you text messages.
Yep. I understand why companies were doing it. They were doing it to try, before this case law started developing, to kind of constrict the scope of the consent and avoid claims that, no, I meant it to everything. They were trying to address exactly what that question's about and what you're talking about, Kelly. And that is why I like if it says reply stop to stop text, because then I don't see any reason why you need to send a confirmation, even if the Bureau's rule will let you. And looking at the questions, because you reminded me that we get those, I saw another one about if there are any specific states where we cannot send text messages in relation to collecting a debt. I hope that our listeners will forgive me that I am not going to tell you one way or the other if in all 50 states, every law that's out there, how it operates, because candidly, I don't have them all memorized. But to try to give a partial answer, my thought, there are some state laws that apply specifically to texting on their express terms. There are some that do it more implicitly in saying communications, calls, things like that. And there are some that impose requirements like hours of operation, business address, in written communications that might make texting really difficult to do. And so I definitely think, I'm not prepared to say there is a state that on its books prohibits it. I'm not aware of one. But there are definitely, absolutely laws that make it more difficult and could actually have the impact of a company saying, in these jurisdictions, I'm just not going to use it.
Yeah, so I have a question about that. And I also was thinking about, you know, unsubscribe to text, or, you know, opt out to text also would apply to unsubscribe to emails, right? Making sure that it doesn't just say unsubscribe. But when we're talking about specific states, you know, I know off the top of my head, for sure, I was yelling what as like a what? You don't know all the state laws off the top of your head? What are you talking about?
I feel like I should at this point.
There are too many. But distinctly New York comes to mind, not for texting, but for email. A debt collector cannot email in New York without the consumer's express consent. And that's email about a debt. I wanted to ask, for folks that are, you know, setting up texting or whatever with those states, like, I know, I feel like Hawaii and Georgia are definitely one of them, Maine, that require your office hours or phone number to be on, you know, written communications. I've looked through those several times, you know, to make sure, you know, would a text fall under this? And if my text provides a link to a communication or remind someone, hey, go check your email, and that email has all of those notices, does that make my text okay if it doesn't have my office hours and phone numbers in it? I'm specifically asking for your legal.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I don't know. I do not view the existing environment as one where there are answers. There are arguments. there are not answers.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, and I hate to be the pessimistic outside lawyer that's no fun, but I don't see answers coming through many channels other than making some good case law. And I think that, and maybe we go back and ask for further guidance from the Bureau, and hopefully they're still in a mindset where they might be willing to give it. I mean, it depends what happens in 2020 and all of that, but this is a time where I do think we have to be very intentional about what we do, and then very intentional about what we fight, because mm-hmm. we need to make some rules to answer some of these questions. And there may be some states and jurisdictions where it's easier to do that than others. There may be some cases where the facts make it more easy to do that than others. But it's really important that the industry be, I think, very intentional in that way as we implement these technologies and begin to see the plaintiff claims that result.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Lauren, I know one of the things also you wanted to spend a few minutes talking about today was had something to do with Facebook and its recent petition to have a case heard before the Supreme Court, and how that could have some impact on the topic we're discussing today.
Yeah, so I'm actually just kind of curious to hear my panelists' thoughts on the Facebook's recent cert petition to the Supreme Court. One thing that kind of stood out to me in there is that they are squarely looking, or I guess you could say, asking for opinion on, for example, the Ninth Circuit's very broad interpretation of what an ATDS is. And they pointed out, hey, there is a clear split here between how the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit has defined what an ATDS is. And so I was just kind of curious to hear what the panelists' thoughts were on that topic. So I don't know, it seems like this is a moving target, but do you guys have any thoughts on that?
You know, Lauren, this is Stephanie. I think it's a valid thing to discuss, but candidly, I don't yet. Not beyond what you've already said. Yeah. It's something that I think remains to be seen, and I haven't been able to focus on to this extent. So I would just be guessing.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that's interesting in their petition is they're pointing out that, hey, the Ninth Circuit's wildly overbroad definition of an ATDS essentially makes all cell phones, regular old cell phones, where you've got speed dial, for example, converts that into an ATDS. So it should be interesting to kind of see if that even gets any attention. I know not many cases get selected by the Supreme Court, but this would be great if it was for our industry to provide some clarification.
It'd be amazing, but I wonder, with the current makeup of the court and the fact that the FCC has a rulemaking and that it reopened its rulemaking after the Marks v. Crunch decision, and I know there have been more decisions expanding from that in the Ninth Circuit, I don't know. I could see them waiting for the agency to do it. I do know that they're supposed to be deciding the Hobbs Act deference issue, and it's a whole different conversation about where I think they may or may not come out on that. But long story short, I think that it's very possible they could come out that the level of deference may not be as high as the Hobbs Act. And if that's the case, then leaving the rulemaking to the FCC won't necessarily fix the issue we have in the Ninth Circuit. That's why, for me, it's just too messy to really know. I think I need to see the Supreme Court rule on a couple of the pending stuff first to mm-hmm. know and try to see if this is going to actually have any traction, if, to your point, cert is granted.
Right.
Can I mention one quick thing?
Sure.
Because we're talking about text, and I'm sure everybody is really excited to go in text. And we may decide to just do limited content, but we may decide, when we have consent, to go more aggressively and we can control for the handful of states that might make that more difficult. I want to just flag for people something that is going on, which is as part of Stir Shaken, the cell phone carriers are blocking text, not just labeling, blocking text that they view to be quote unquote aggressive collection communications. It is, in my view, a reaction that may not, it's coming from a good place, but is going in a direction that is having a very overbroad impact. People are aware of this, but I'm not sure it's going to change anytime soon. We haven't had any luck yet in getting the carriers to provide kind of a definitive list of what kind of information, including it being included in a text, could put it at risk of being blocked by the carrier and therefore never getting to your consumer. But we do understand words like delinquent, past due, overdue, and late, which are very common terms that are often used in collection communications that I would not consider to be aggressive at all. Like, hi, your payment's past due. Please call us, Mini Miranda, because we're third party. As I understand it, those right now either are or certainly are at risk of being blocked with some or all carriers. I don't have a lot more detail there, but it really adds a wrinkle into this and the utility. If it's actually happening and continues to happen, well, I mean, I know it's happening. If it keeps happening going forward, it will limit, you essentially have to use a limited content message for text, period. And that would be an imposition, that would be a rule being imposed by cell phone carriers. So I just want to flag that. And I don't know, Kelly, Lauren, have you heard anything about this? Seen it?
I have not heard about it with text messages, but I know from personal experience the difficulty we're having with products like AT&T has pushed out to all their subscribers something called Call Protect, which labels calls. And for example, I know that's something that our agency is struggling with, our calls being labeled as spam. So that way, I've got calls where consumers are like really reluctant to talk to us because our call is showing up as spam. So I have not heard it in the context of text messages. That's really, really interesting and also alarming, because there really isn't a process for legitimate agencies or companies to follow to let those carriers know, at least not to my knowledge, without going through some type of solution to say, hey, I'm a legitimate company, please stop labeling my phone number that way. So that's pretty alarming, but I haven't heard about it with text.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk to people offline about the sources of the information, and then they can go and test it for themselves. I find it credible enough to bring it to people's attention, but I hope people can understand. I don't want to say the specific contacts, people, companies that I know and probably can disclose are dealing with this in this forum.
Got it. Well, we've reached the top of the hour, but I'm not going to let everybody off the hook just yet. What I'd like to do before we wrap up is maybe just go around the panel quickly and share any parting words of wisdom, any other key takeaways, maybe any other thoughts that you get a chance to bring up today because the conversation just didn't get to that point, or any other just give you an opportunity to summarize your thoughts on this topic, if you don't mind. Kelly, would you mind going first?
Not at all. Thank you so much again. Always fun. I always learn things, especially from you two ladies. So I would say, number one, when you are evaluating your communications, whatever form they are, don't forget to think about the obligations under these two different statutes separately, because they are different and distinct obligations. Number two, the more specific you can be in your communications about opting out, opt out of text, unsubscribe to email, will make your life easier in terms of processing those on your end and communicating those opt-outs and communication preferences to your clients. Thanks.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. Stephanie?
I would say consider using limited content texts until some answers are given in various areas. Secondly, if you decide to send collection texts, make sure you're doing so on accounts where you still have consent, and include a reply stop to stop text in your text, and don't do anything else to confirm it.
Well said. Thank you. Lauren?
I would just say, hey, this is a moving target. There are perhaps no right or wrong answers per se, so just keep up to date with all the moving parts in order to make sure you're able to quickly adapt your compliance programs.
Awesome. Excellent. Well, before I let everybody go, Lauren, Stephanie, Kelly, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insights with us today. I very much appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to help educate and inform everybody else in the industry for no other reason than your own selflessness. So thank you very much. That was very nice. I really appreciate it. I also want to thank TCN again for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.tcn.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated, especially those who asked questions. Final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar when you get a chance. Really would appreciate that. This event has been recorded. A recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net later today or tomorrow. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Thank you very much. Panel, awesome job. You rocked it. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good day.
Bye, guys.